we appreciate you coming back on the program with us. I absolutely love the book. And one of the things that I especially enjoyed was the format, which I thought was really effective, shifting back and forth between contemporary events and what I guess we would call the backstory of your life.
Well, that's what I always called it, was the backstory. It seemed to work out pretty well, and it started off as a theory, and then it somewhere around 150,000 words. I guess I sort of realized that it was actually comprehensible, And one thing we did go back through and put dates at the head of each section so that people wouldn't get confused about where they were. But, it was a constant contrast between the way I was raised and my, my father's position in the Baptist church and, this ultra religious upbringing and where I really was in those crazy late 60s. So in that way, it clearly worked as a contrast.
Well, speaking of your father, his job made for you and your siblings a pretty nomadic existence, and also tagged you with a nickname that caused trouble along the way when they would call you Preacher. What role did music play in helping you cope with all those changes?
Well, moving every 2 years or so, it was kind of like being an army brat. Maybe it was worse. I don't know. But we never, I'm talking about my siblings and I, my brother and my three sisters, we never had the chance to put down roots. We were always in the stage where you're trying to make friends, which is really not a good place to be for a kid. I would say that, I retreated into my own world to a great extent, and that part of my world was pretending that I was a pilot and pretending that my bicycle was a jet plane and I was thousands of feet above the earth. And somewhere along the way, I kind of created a place where I could write things. I could write stories because I love science fiction, so I would write science fiction stories. And I just came up with this kind of secret room in my consciousness where I did the things I wanted to do, where I felt safe.
I really related to the stories relating to the death of your mother. She died at 36. My mom passed away at 33. Was there a sense when your mom died, did it feel like you had, in some sense, lost your mooring, or to use the flight analysis here, to lose your North Star in many ways?
Well, she was the cohesive, binding center of our family, and I often describe it as a kind of nuclear strike on our family, because we have never been the same, and all my brothers and sisters are still alive, and my father survived until last year, but he was completely decommissioned, and I think he had a very, very rough time staying in the ministry. And eventually he wasn't able to stay in the ministry. And my youngest sisters, who were 4 and 6, they never knew my mother at all. And they grew up with a yearning, with a real, real missing place in their, in their consciousness for their mother. Who was she, and what was she like? And as it was, I was 16 years old when Mom passed, and I realized that I had only spent about 10 years knowing her, right? Really being a conscious being and really knowing my mother. And she was so busy with everybody that I think we all missed out on something, that's for sure.
I was struck by what your father said to all of you as you were getting ready for her funeral.
Oh. Well, my father said, let's go out there and show them how the webs bury their dead. You know, I mean, he was a Marine, and probably was not the most sensitive thing for him to say, but we always watched our behavior as preacher's kids. We were on view all the time, and people were judging us, and he did not want us hysterical and screaming and squalling. And he made it very clear, and we followed through on that because we generally did what he told us to do.
The relationship with your father was certainly a complex one. When he passed away back in December, you wrote about it on social media and talked about it. Did you get a chance to share any of the book with him?
I talked to him about it a lot. I actually got some quotes from him going back to when he and mother got married in a hurry just before he went over for the Second World War, went over to the South Pacific, and they eloped, and he and her parents got wind of it, and he talks about how I said, well, what was that like? He talked about how they were on a Greyhound bus going down to Lubbock, Texas, and they thought they were going to make a clean getaway. And I said, what happened when you got down to Lubbock, Dad? And he said, the place was crawling with cops. Crawling with cops. It was something quite pithy and, you know, memorable about the way he put it. And they threw him in jail. And I said, how'd you feel about that, Dad? And he said, well, I was pretty blue. You know, people don't really talk like that anymore. But I guess, you know, they put a stop to it anyway. But they were married. They were married. There was nothing they could do about it. And she waited for him 37 months.
And then he came home, and about 9 months and 15 minutes later, as he put it, right?
Well, he always said that he came home on the on a battleship, the USS Maryland, and he said 9 months and 45 minutes after he got off the boat, I was born.
We're talking with Jimmy Webb. Book is called The Cake and the Rain. And throughout the book, as you examine the first 25 years or so of your life, there's a dichotomy between your image as part of the establishment at the time, playing for Sinatra and people like that, and the lifestyle that you were living in Los Angeles. Was that life that you were living a reaction to that image, or was it just a part of the whole picture of who young Jimmy Webb was?
Well, I wanted to definitely be a part of my generation, and I was fortunate, and I didn't realize how fortunate I was to have Mr. Sinatra and others like Liza Minnelli and Barbara Streisand and Stan Kenton and wonderful people like Louis Armstrong. Interested in my music and interested in me as a person. Johnny Mercer called me up one day and wanted to talk about writing songs. And I mean, it was heady stuff, but the truth is that I went, you know, I had gone to Monterey to the pop festival and played there with the Johnny Rivers Band. And, I wanted to be a hippie. I wanted to be where the action was, and if indulging in marijuana or whatever the going thing was, if it would get me closer to the people I wanted to be close to, then I was partaking.
Speaking of that,
I wanted to show that I wasn't a, quote, square. And, got me into a lot of trouble.
When you mentioned the Monterey Pop Festival, I laughed out loud reading the section in the book about the planning for that, because we had the great good fortune to talk with P.F. Sloan not long before he passed away, and he had told us the story about you two being tossed out of the meeting with Lou Adler and John Phillips because you were just the songwriters.
Yeah, we went down and sat in the back of Johnny Rivers' black Buick Riviera two-door coupe and had a joint. And while they planned the pop festival, and between them it was Adler, it was John Phillips and Michelle, it was Simon and Garfunkel, and it was Johnny. And I think between them they came up with around $40,000 to open an office and sort of get the wheels in motion. But the secret genius behind all that was a guy named Bernie Siegel. And he was, I said in the book, you know, that he resembled Captain Kangaroo. But he wanted it to be a free concert. And he was a real dyed-in-the-wool, you know, Allen Ginsberg hippie. The truth is that once John and Lou got a hold of it, there was no way we weren't going to charge for tickets. And it turned into also a film, which they owned, called Monterey Pop. And it was just very interesting to see the counterculture playing ball in a very establishment ballpark. The way they approached the business end of the Monterey Pop Festival.
The
Summer of Love, unquote, right?
Mm. The book also answers the question about MacArthur Park, or as Richard Harris called it, MacArthur's Park. You took inspiration from the poet W.H. Auden and the true story of the breakup of a relationship, and there were no drugs involved in that.
No, not at all. I mean, I'm not... I was not squeaky clean. You know, I had some, you know, beer drinking sessions in college, and it gradually, you know, I puffed on a few, definitely inhaled. I'd puffed on a few marijuana cigarettes, but I had not yet. Well, Derek Taylor used to call LSD, a little bit of the old dreaded heaven and hell, unquote. I'd never been there, and it was too early for cocaine. So there was some drinking, and there was a little puffing going on, okay? But there was nothing hallucinogenic going on in my life. And MacArthur Park was really everything that I write about in MacArthur Park, the old men playing checkers by the trees and the cake and the rain. Everything is something that I physically saw. I mean, I saw with my own eyes. It was put together in a very surrealistic way. It was deliberately kind of, it was a curveball for the listener. It was like, you figure this out, you know, and it was a lot of songs were written that way. Bob Dylan wrote a lot of songs that way, and Lennon and McCartney wrote a lot of songs that way. It was like the onus was on the listener to sign it. And decode what was going on.
And as you point out in the book, it also changed your life, but it changed popular music and top 40 radio as well. The song of that length could get played. The Beatles even added a little extra to Hey Jude as a response.
Well, it changed things for a while. I mean, it actually shook up top 40 radio's playlists because they had their 3-minute songs, and they had their commercials, and they were slotted in there pretty tightly. And then all of a sudden, here's this record that's 7 minutes, 21 seconds long. And they were playing it, all of it. And I was getting paid 3 times. I was getting paid for 3 songs
every time
they played it. So, yes, and the story was recounted to me by George Martin, and I've never had any reason to doubt, and I made a record with it, and always loved the guy, that they all went to the studio one night, and they made a tape loop for the end of Hey Jude, and they all stood at the console and put a new ending on the record that measured out to, I believe it was 7 minutes 17 seconds.
We're talking with Jimmy Webb here. As the book draws to a close, you dodged death a couple of times with a Henry Diltz and a glider, and then with a really tough drug overdose. Now, you mentioned in the acknowledgments book two. I sure hope there is going to be a book two. But did those moments really mark a turning point for you in your life?
Well, they scared me. They scared me. And it was not the kind of... well, I'm never going to do that again, or I continued flying sailplanes. I got a new one as soon as I could, and I continued to dabble in, you know, cocaine use and for years. I hasten to add that I've been sober for 18 years, so. I mean, completely sober for 18 years, and for years before that, I stopped using coke much longer ago. But you know, it wasn't. But I tell you what, I had some new boundaries for myself. I wouldn't take anything that was offered to me. You know, I mean, I would not. It would have to be something that I had identified and knew exactly what it was that I was dealing with. Because that night, that was just simply misidentification. Right. That was just taking something that was not at all what I thought it was.
A wonderful event is coming up soon on May 3rd at Carnegie Hall. Some of your dearest friends will gather together for a celebration of the book and your music. And that's got to be gratifying to have so many of them coming together.
It's great because, you know, a lot of them are the original provocateurs, you know, who went out and got hits for me. Johnny Rivers, who originally recorded By the Time I Get to Phoenix, he'll be there. Billy and Marilyn Davis, who originated in the Fifth Dimension, are going to be doing Up and Away. Judy Collins will be there doing The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And Amy Grant, who's one of my long time supporters and fellow Oklahomans, Toby Keith, and Hanson will be there, believe it. You know, Hanson, which I didn't, you know, really know them when they were in their previous reincarnation, but these guys are great, and they're coming, and it's going to be quite a night.
And will you get a chance to come up to Maine again this summer?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I wrote most of the Cake Out in the Rain. I wrote on my front porch up in Maine at Hugh Pond, over by Lake, down by Lake Teasy, I should say. And I'm there. I was there every summer when my kids were growing up, and that's been a while now. My kids are. You know, they're 30s now. But I love it. I love it. I love to take 3 or 4 weeks and just be at the pond and free up my mind, as they say. And Maine is a really, is a true American wilderness. It's like no other place in America.
Well, Jimmy, it's a joy for us to talk with you once again. We wish you much success with the book, and it's an absolutely phenomenal read. Some amazing stories, and I think a great positive outlook that you bring to all of the many adventures you've had along the way.
I thank you for your support and for having me on the show.
Thanks again, Jimmy. We appreciate it.
All right. God bless you for that. Thank you.
You bet. Enjoy tonight.
All right.